I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In a moment, our conversation with the U.S. Marine who tried to alert the world to the genocide in Darfur, armed with just a camera. But first, we want to check in Pakistan, where the President, General Pervez Musharraf, imposed a state of emergency on Saturday. Today, in the city of Lahore, police swung batons and fired tear gas to disperse hundreds of protesting lawyers, who responded by throwing stones and striking back with tree branches. A couple of thousand opposition members have reportedly been arrested. Musharraf cited security concerns for imposing the state of emergency, but analysts say it's more likely he wanted to prevent the Supreme Court from declaring his re-election last month illegal. Musharraf sacked half of that court when he declared the state of emergency, which many are actually calling martial law. Shahan Mufti is a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. He joins us from Islamabad. And Shahan, how does former Prime Minister Benazir Bhutto fit into this picture now? We're reminded she struck a deal with Musharraf that allowed her to return to Pakistan after years in exile, the thinking that they might share power if he kept the presidency, she would run for prime minister. But she was out of the country the night Musharraf imposed the emergency. So will he now arrest her?
She returned the night of the emergency, and she herself commented that she was surprised that she was not arrested. She traveled from Karachi to Islamabad today. This is putting public pressure on her to come out and express where she stands in between the opposition and President Musharraf. She has not clearly come out on either side yet. All eyes are on her in some ways.
Well, you write that the army would be loath to remove Musharraf at this point, but in the past, previous military rulers have been ousted when the public uprising became too much and the army couldn't ignore it. So what is your sense that that may happen this time around?
Today was a very eventful day. Around noon, some very strong rumors started circulating in the media and just in Pakistan, all over Pakistan, that General Isfakyani, who is the vice chief of army staff, had overthrown President Musharraf as president and had as chief of the army and had taken over command of the country. These rumors proved to be wrong only after President Musharraf himself had to come out in public and say that these rumors were untrue. But that just shows you that there is a real sense in this country that this is a possibility, that something like this can happen. These things have happened in the past. The first martial law administrator, the first chief of the army who ruled Pakistan in the 1950s and 60s, had to hand over power to a junior officer. The officer who took over from him had to step down because of pressures from within the army. And then the last president was mysteriously assassinated. There is the sense that this has happened in the past, that the army has removed leaders once they do become a liability on the army itself. Whether the army is close to deciding that, whether the top brass of the army thinks that President Musharraf has become a liability on them, that can only be seen in time.
Well, and as you and others report, and we spoke about this this past Friday, the U.S. is in a tricky position here. Pakistan, one of the few countries in the world that receives cash directly from the U.S., the U.S. giving Pakistan $11 billion in aid since the 9/11 attacks. But Secretary of Defense Robert Gates said today he doesn't want to do anything to undermine the efforts of Pakistan in counterterrorism fighting. Is it likely that the U.S. is going to do anything to send any kind of message to Pakistan?
Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice apparently asked President Musharraf today to doff his army uniform, to let go of his army position. This is the first time that the Secretary of State has come out so strongly and clearly on the issue of President Musharraf's dual role as President and Chief of the Army. So there's definitely pressure building up on Pervez Musharraf as well, and pressure building up on the United States, who are faced with a position where President Musharraf is making Washington look bad.
By the way, we know many news services have been shut down, the BBC Pakistan,
yeah.
CNN.
Yeah.
Do you feel as if your work is going to be cut off?
The internet was out for a while. They turned it off when the rumors started coming around.
Mm-hmm.
And, all the domestic media is off air. And BBC, CNN, everything's off. I had some access to satellite feed today, so mm-hmm. that was good. But it's becoming difficult. I think print media is still... Well, actually, they attacked some print media. They bust some print media as well today, but domestic. But I don't feel anything yet.
Shahan Mufti, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor, speaking to us from Islamabad. Shahan, thanks as always.
Thank you, Robin. It was a pleasure.
Now to Sudan, where there's been some progress in peace talks between the North and the South, while peace talks about Darfur have stalled. Today, Sudan's North and South have reportedly agreed on a plan to carry out the 2005 peace agreement, which ended two decades of civil war. Well, former Marine Captain Brian Steidel first went to Sudan to monitor that ceasefire between the North and the South, and while there, he began hearing terrible stories of unrest to the west in a place called Darfur. Rebels there wanted the same rights granted to the Sudanese in the South, but when those Darfur rebels rose up against the repressive government in Khartoum, they were brutally put down by the government-backed Arab militias, the Janjaweed. Brian headed to Darfur in 2004 and for 6 months documented the genocide there. Riding in a helicopter, he even followed trucks filled with Janjaweed leaving a leveled village. But per African Union rules, he was armed with only a camera. All he could do was watch.
And I was just taking pictures with my camera the whole time. You know, I have these two trucks that are going by just thinking, we could end this right now. If we had a mandate to defend these people, and if I was looking through a scope instead of looking through the lens of my camera, these vehicles would be done. These people could return to their village and they'd be safe. Well, I was taking pictures.
Working with filmmakers, Brian turned his pictures and reports into the documentary The Devil Came on Horseback, which is just out on DVD, and watching it is like watching a man try to stop a genocide with one hand tied behind his back. And Brian Steidel joins us from NPR West with more. Welcome.
Thank you.
Remind us, The Devil Came on Horseback, your title comes from?
The Devil Came on Horseback is taken from the literal translation of Janjaweed, which means a devil on a horse.
Right. When you first started seeing the result of their killing and writing your reports, taking pictures, what did you think would be the result?
Originally, the whole purpose for writing the reports and taking the pictures was to be a part of the African Union mission of monitoring this ceasefire. I had no intention of releasing them to the press when I came back to the United States.
If you could describe, for those who haven't seen the film yet, some of the things that you saw. I'm thinking of the girls' school or what happened at a displaced persons camp.
We would show up in these villages or these IDP camps. The government had just basically wiped these people out, them and their proxy militias, the Janjaweed, had attacked and raped individuals and mutilated them and burned them alive and just basically destroyed their lives.
Yeah. You would say to yourself, geez, if troops could come in here, you know, we could clean this up in a matter of days.
I figured that if the world could see what I had seen, you know, everybody would do everything in their power, governments, individuals, to try to stop what was happening.
There's one woman in particular early on. She just takes your breath away. She had been routed from Darfur. As we were saying, she was one of these internally displaced by the Janjaweed. She knows how she looks to you. She says, you know, you probably don't believe I'm a teacher. And then she goes on in just increasing despair. Let's listen.
If you say I'm a teacher, can you believe me? My brother and my father and my aunt and uncle, not see. Because we are scattered like seeds in the sun. Because we are bravely. Here now, nearly of the 2 hours, we are trembling. Because we've been trembling because our mother, our aunt. We're having nothing. We're having none. We're having none. Because I am loving my country. My country, my country, my country.
And I'm thinking as I'm watching that, as she says, you know, we're scattered like seeds, we're trembling, our mother, my country. She's just one.
One of 2 million.
It was impossible to look away from that woman in the film. How difficult was it for you to walk away from people like her? I mean, you had to.
You did. I mean, our job was to simply monitor, and it was hard. We felt like taking these pictures and writing these reports that something was going to happen. We felt that ship was just over the horizon, and we were going to see it any day now. You know, the UN was going to rush down and stop this. All the good countries of the world were going to come to help rescue these people because we were sending these reports up. And then we found out that our reports weren't going anywhere.
You wrote 80 reports. What happened to them?
Out of those, I was told that 4 of them had reached the American embassy. And the way it travels is it takes 3-4 months to get there. So that by the time this information is released, there's nothing that they can do.
In the meantime, you and others would know in advance of attacks, and you in particular offered yourself up. You told the African Union, I'll stand. We know this attack's going to happen. I'll stand between the Africans and the Janjaweed. And you were told what?
Well, we were told, no, that we don't have a mandate to do that. You know, that we're here to monitor, and that's all we're going to do.
Well, you left Darfur in disgust, and it sounded like you weren't prepared for what happened next. What did happen? And I'm thinking of New York Times columnist Nick Kristof.
Well, my sister Gretchen, Gretchen Wallace, who's one of the producers on the film and also the co-author of our book, she had been talking to Nicholas Kristof before I had returned and said, hey, look, my brother's got these pictures, and maybe we should, you know, set up a meeting. So after I came back, I just showed him the photographs and started telling him some stories. And he was blown away. He said, nobody has photographs like this, with the government actually attacking and burning and looting and their helicopter gunship shooting on civilians. And so he wanted to publish a story. And the first one he published, called The Secret Genocide Archives, had four of the photos in it. And then the second one, after I allowed him to release my name, which was a...
Now, why were you concerned? I'm thinking you are Marine, but why were you concerned?
I was concerned that, one, you know, for my personal safety, for the fact that could I get another job such as this one somewhere else around the world?
Yes, we should say this was a job that you actually got over the Internet. At this point, you were an ex-Marine, but you really wanted to make a difference, so you went online and found this job working with the African Union. But in your film, you also express another concern. While there were increasingly Americans who wanted to see your pictures, your proof, you met people who didn't want to see this. You spoke and showed your photos at the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. You took questions from the audience, and many of the questions came from Sudanese who were working at the embassy nearby. Let's listen to what they said.
The characterization of the conflict in Darfur between Arabs and Africans is totally misunderstanding situation there.
What I saw is not completely dramatic as I thought. And I thought maybe I missed two or three pictures in the beginning from the presentation, but it seemed to me like I didn't miss really anything.
As a Sudanese, I'm sorry, Mr. Bryan, I haven't seen any picture showing genocide, mass rape, mass killing, anything.
The pictures that you showed were unbelievably dramatic of corpses, parts of corpses. What are you thinking when you're hearing this?
I had expected it. This is what the Sudanese government does. They still continuously deny that they support and train and arm the Janjaweed and command them, which is well documented and well proven. Everybody knows that, I mean, that they lie about this time and time again, and yet the world continues to allow them to do it. And that's the most frustrating part about it.
That's former U.S. Marine Brian Steidel. His pictures of the genocide in Darfur did eventually shock the world, help spark a social movement, but as we heard, it was slow going. And the peace talks in Libya have stalled, so we're going to take a break. And when we come back, we want to ask Brian, what does he think will happen next? Also, quick note, later in the program, drought in the south, the worst in the country. One town in Tennessee turns on the water for just a few hours every night. We'll have that story as well. Back in 1 minute, here and now. Our conversation today continues with former Marine Captain Brian Steidel. His story is told in the film The Devil Came on Horseback, now out in DVD. He was an early witness to the Darfur tragedy as an observer for the African Union. His photographs of charred bodies and smoking villages, published in the New York Times in 2005, were among the first images the world had seen of the conflict. And Brian, after that media blitz, you spoke at the Save Darfur rally in Washington with Barack Obama and others. You were greeted like a hero, and you talked then about what you represented as an American in Darfur.
I always get asked, why is this important to us? I'll tell you why. I landed in the village of Isban to try to figure out if the government had bombed the village or not. And I was introduced, Brian from America. And the entire village stood up and applauded me. Because they felt that George Bush had landed in their town, and the Army and the Navy and the Air Force and the Marines were behind me. We have the power here in America. The people have the power to stand up and say, genocide, never again.
Brian, now there is movement. People, for instance, appealing to China to end its support of Sudan. Peace talks, albeit stalled. A lot going on. Is that enough for you?
Well, I'm very glad that there is this, you know, grassroots movement in the United States. I mean, that's amazing. It's one of the largest we've seen since the efforts to end apartheid in South Africa. And I think it's 20 states now have divested their pension funds from companies that are complicit in the genocide. People know what it is. At least they know that now, because I still get asked from time to time, you know, who's Darfur? With all of that being said, the situation on the ground has still not changed. And since we started this fight, an additional 200, 250,000 people have died. An additional million people have been displaced from their homes. This has to stop.
You and your sister end up going to a refugee camp in Chad. You spoke with several refugees. One man in particular who told you a moving story about his village being bombed, and then his complaint to you. Let's listen.
We received many, many things from America, even the sack, the food, the oil, medicine, many support. We pray for American people. Thank you. We received nothing from Islamic. We are Muslim, you know. Mm-hmm. Where are Arab people here? We never seen Arabic wandering around here to ask what you need and how you live here. They hated us. They want us to hate others. This is our problem.
Brian Steidel, that man telling you, you know, we are Muslim. It's Arab Muslims in the government in Sudan who are attacking African Muslims in Darfur. It's a complicated story in that way as well.
It is, and it's hard for us to, you know, if you look at the pictures, you can't tell the difference between them yet. They're Arab Africans and they're black Africans, but they have these different tribal links. For example, I'm part German and Irish, and, you know, on certain days I could tell my kids that they're Irish, and then they'll grow up, you know, thinking that they're Irish, and then they tell their kids, well, you're Irish. And so because of that, they have formed this, you know, very elite group of individuals that believe that they are 100% Arab, that don't have anything to do with Africans, and they believe that they are a lesser race because that's what they've been taught. And well, those are the members that make up this John Jaweed group.
Well, I guess I'm also thinking of that man asking you, where are the Arab countries? The European Union is sending peacekeeping troops to the region in a month. But some Americans are thinking other countries should do more, and also asking, what more can Americans do? We don't want war. Look what happened in Iraq. The best intentions can go awry. Colin Powell and President Bush labeled Darfur a genocide before many other world leaders did. And millions of Americans pour aid money into Darfur.
And all of this is great, but it's not stopping it. And we need to stop it, or they're going to be there forever. We're going to continue this cycle of just handing out food to people and them living in these squalid camps. We need to stop what's going on. There's many more things that our government can do. Travel bans. Why has the UN not passed weapons sanctions against Sudan unilaterally? Why has there not been a proposed economic sanctions to stop all economic trade with them, to stop the oil that's pumping out of the ground that is funding this? Why is there not a no-fly zone? We can stop these things from happening on the ground without deploying U.S. troops. Nobody is advocating for U.S. troops on the ground. We're advocating for things like no-fly zones to stop the helicopter gunships, the MiGs and the Antonovs from bombing civilian villages.
Last week, all the parties met in Libya, but the top refugee group leaders didn't go. One sat it out in Paris. And there is concern that, in fact, the leadership isn't there on the part of the Darfur rebels. Do you worry about that as well?
Well, I do. I think these rebel groups have fractured into many different groups. There is no one strong leader to unite them at this point in time. And that's a sad thing. I look back, you know, not just to when the peace talks started, but I look back to the 4 weeks before that. And that entire time, the government of Sudan was on a major offensive, attacking refugee camps, attacking major villages to throw off these rebel groups from their feet, to leave them picking up pieces. And then they showed up at the talks and said, hey, we'll call for a ceasefire now. Of course you call for a ceasefire now. You just displaced an additional 20, 40,000 people. And this is the tactics all along. This is what they did in the South. This is what anybody who was educated on the situation knew that they were going to do. We know that they don't mean to have peace talks, that they are going to continue to marginalize, displace, and kill these people as long as they get away with it.
former U.S. Marine Captain Brian Steidel. The Devil Came on Horseback is a new film documenting his work in Darfur and beyond. It's now out on DVD, and he has a book of the same name that you're now preparing for a paperback, do I understand, with updated information?
Yes, paperback should be out in the spring.
Yeah. For more on the film and to see some of Brian's photographs, which, by the way, Brian, the photographs in the film in particular are raw, some of the most raw I've ever seen. Did you hold back ones that were even worse?
They're as bad as they need to be. You know, these things shouldn't happen, and people shouldn't have to see them.
But people should see them, I guess is your point.
Yes.
Yeah. Brian, thanks so much.
Thank you.
And for those photos, you can go to here-now.org. Okay, looking ahead, tomorrow on Here and Now, has the U.S. opened a new front in the practice of extraordinary rendition, outsourcing terrorist suspects for interrogation in Africa, but sending their wives and children to secret jails as well? That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, the life of Pi with pictures. Back after the news, Here and Now. In a few minutes, we're going to hear about new pain treatment for pets. But first, the drought that's hit the West, from Southern California to Arizona and up through the Northern Rockies, was brought into sharp focus by last week's wildfires. But southern states are suffering the worst droughts in the country right now and the worst on record. Some of the most dramatic pictures in the South came from Lake Lanier in Georgia, with boats beached on mudflats and wooden docks stretching over parched land. Lake Lanier supplies water to Atlanta and parts of Alabama and Florida. Last week, the Bush administration brokered a water-sharing deal between the states to try to prevent cities from running out of water in 3 to 9 months. In a minute, we'll speak with the mayor of a small town in Tennessee where the well, so to speak, is already dry. But first, Brian Fuchs, a climatologist at the National Drought Mitigation Center at the University of Nebraska. Brian, you've developed a map monitoring the drought. You categorize the South as exceptional drought. Most of the West, for instance, is severe and extreme. So what does that mean, exceptional?
That exceptional drought situation is something that we term a 1-in-50-year event. And so the conditions that we're looking at are both the precipitation and water supply issues, but we really are concentrating on the impacts associated with the drought and the types of impacts we're seeing with people running out of water and the vegetation die-off that we're seeing. That really is what we categorize a 1-in-50-year or exceptional drought situation, which is the worst conditions that we do show on the U.S. Drought Monitor.
I'm wondering, what's the impact of development in the South? We know it has an impact in the Southwest and in places like Arizona, but, you know, with the explosion of population in Atlanta, for instance, does the city then become like a sponge?
I think the impact of development and the population growth in the Southeast is something that many of the water managers in the region may not have fully have understood the impact of this on their water supply. So I think when the situation does subside and we do go back to normal conditions in the Southeast, the population growth is something that really needs to be considered and how that is impacting current and future water supplies to those population areas.
Even when the drought ends, as you say. But would you see the drought ending? I mean, we're in a minute going to hear about streams drying up. You know, what direction is it going to go in?
What we're really anticipating over the next several months is the southern tier of states, southern Alabama, southern Georgia, most of Florida, even into the Carolinas, that dryness is going to persist, and we may even see some of the drought that we see further to the north expand southward into the winter months.
Brian Fuchs, a climatologist at the National Drought Mitigation Center at the University of Nebraska in Lincoln. By the way, go to our website, here-now.org, if you'd like to look at their drought map. Brian, thanks for your help.
Thank you.
Well, water has already evaporated in the small former coal mining town of Orme, Tennessee, population 150 or so. It's become the first town in the region to literally run dry. Joining us now is Orme Mayor Tony Reams. And Mayor Reams, I understand for years your town got water from a beautiful mountain stream. What happened?
It's just over time. It's just, you know, it's just dwindled down to nothing. These last 2 or 3 years we've had droughts in this area. Still ain't putting out enough.
Yeah, tell us more about what was happening as the water started to dry up from the stream.
Well, we started in probably mid-July cutting back on our water supply to the people. And then in August, we just had to start letting them have it 3 hours a day.
Yeah. We understand you have a reservoir, but it was running dry?
Yes, it's running dry. You'd have to leave it off like 12 hours just to get 3 hours running. So.
Yeah. Well, now we understand that what you've done is, first of all, turn the taps off. How do you run the source of water to you? Because you've got, what, 35 homes in the town?
That's correct.
Yeah. So how do you regulate the water?
Well, what we do, we take in power trucks and we fill that tank up. And at the end of 3 hours, it's cut off. I mean, they don't get no more. You know, and that's all they get.
And how do you, where do you truck it in from?
We're trucking it in from about 2.5-3 miles down the road. It's the city of Bridgeport, Alabama's line. They've donated water to us, but we still have to pay the drivers and pay the gas and diesel.
How much is this costing you?
So far, around $8,000 for the last 3.5 months.
So you're trucking in water from Bridgeport, Alabama to Orem, Tennessee, your town, and you're putting it in your tank, but only turning the spigot on for 3 hours. When are those 3 hours?
It's from 6 p.m. to 9 p.m.
Well, now, how are your citizens in Orem reacting? What do they have to do? What are some of the things they're doing to make sure they get this water between 6 and 9?
They catch the water in jugs, munch buckets, and store them back, you know, because they know 3 hours is it.
And I'm sure filling bathtubs and sinks. I mean, I'm sure there are people who have night shifts and people who can't be home between 6 and 9.
That's correct. I've got some that very seldom gets water. They work second shift. What we do on that case, like, say, if we was going to fill the tank today, we'll leave it on all night, and maybe they'll get a little water, you know.
In the morning.
In the morning for the second shifters.
Yeah. I'm sure, you know, we're reading in a local report that at least they have some water. I mean, for a while the spring was running dry, they just would see their taps, you know, sort of sputter and
right.
Nothing come out. So
right.
I'm sure they're grateful to see something, but, you know, what are they saying to you?
Well, they get aggravated, but on the bright side, we got that USDA grant that's putting a trunk line in. They're about halfway completed on it right now, so, you know, the future's bright.
Well, yeah, this is the emergency federal grant that you got for $377,000 to build a water line to connect you to Bridgeport system, the town that's giving you some water right now. So when's that pipeline supposed to be finished?
It should be in by Thanksgiving.
Well, I'm sure that'll be a relief. Well, Mr. Mayor, what do you think the lessons learned here might be for other towns in the South?
They don't need to wait till something goes bad to start conserving. They need to start conserving now, because the way the outlook is on this drought, it's no bright future. They call it for a dry winter.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, even if you had conserved, you know, your spring disappeared.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
But say, you know, everybody that's on the river, what they're looking at, we've got plenty of water, but what they don't realize when these mountain tributaries start drying up, it's going to dwindle down to these rivers, and they're going to start drying too.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, in the meantime, you're a pretty small town. In the coal business left the town, and you're down about 150 people. Do you think you're going to lose more because of this drought situation?
I've had some to threaten, but I don't feel that they'll go because they see the line is going in.
But I understand they have a new appreciation of, you know, the water that pours out of the tap.
Right, they sure do. They don't take it for granted no more. We've got people, if they run their air conditioner, they're catching water to flush the commodes.
Huh. That's so interesting. They're catching the condensation from the air conditioners to
right.
flush the toilet so as not to waste water.
Right.
Huh. Well, Tony Reams, mayor of Orem, Tennessee, where they are trying now to conserve the water that they have. It's the first town in the South to run dry in one of the worst droughts on record in the region. Mayor Reams, thanks for speaking to us.
Bye-bye.
Okay. In about 5 minutes, The Life of Pi with Pictures. It was one of the most imaginative books recently published. Will new illustrations match the images in our minds? That's still ahead. You're listening to Here and Now. veterinary medicine can provide extensive care for pets, including MRIs, chemotherapy, even kidney transplants. But can it help animals when it comes to pain? Producer Diane Toomey takes us to Angel Animal Medical Center here in the Boston area, where the treatment of pet pain is now a priority.
Come on, let's go back here, remember?
Look at you wagging your tail.
I know.
Happy girl.
Diane Buchwald has brought her elderly dog to see veterinarian Lisa Moses. As the King Charles Cavalier Spaniel teeters into the exam room, Moses begins the visit with her usual question.
Okay. How about her current pain level today?
I think she feels pretty good. She's already barked at about four dogs.
Moses is one of the few vets in the country specializing in pain, and she runs something even rarer, a pet pain department here at the Angel Animal Medical Center.
I've been kind of the self-designated champion of pain medicine here for a long time.
So every day, Moses is barraged with requests for help from other vets, like in this case.
Hi, buddy. Buddy having knee surgery?
Yeah, lateral suture.
The little white dog lying on the metal table has already been anesthetized. A colleague has asked Moses to make sure Buddy will also be pain-free after he wakes up.
I am about to attempt to do an epidural injection for this little poodle who is having knee surgery. So here his heart rate speeding up a little bit.
The drug Moses injects into Buddy's lower back will block the dog's sensation of pain for several hours after his surgery.
So he reacted a little bit when he was getting his injection, so I'm going very slow so that he doesn't react anymore.
For years, Moses has been exploring ways to treat pet pain safely but aggressively. She even spent time training at a children's hospital to learn how human doctors deal with pain in their patients who can't communicate. But she says even if pets could talk, they'd probably lie about their pain.
A lot of the species that we work with are prey animals, and they have evolved to hide their pain. Also, different species and even different breeds of pet animals have different pain behavior.
But an individual animal's response to pain isn't all that predictable. For example, some dogs in pain are restless. Others may sleep more.
In cats, it's the same kind of thing.
Moses says a lot of veterinarians have resisted treating pain because it's so difficult to tell whether an animal is hurting and just how much. But she has a different philosophy.
If you expect there to be pain from a particular condition or from a procedure or a surgery, you try treating it and see what the response is.
Vets have also been afraid of side effects from pain medication. But Moses says using smaller dosages of numerous drugs can minimize side effects. She also relies on non-drug therapies like massage, stretching exercises, and acupuncture. That's Cairo, a lab shepherd mix who's pushing 15. He's got arthritis, and he's here today for his regular acupuncture treatment.
Come here, mister.
The friendly dog lies on a floor cushion as Dr. Moses inserts needles into his back. Cairo's owner, Chris Christosik, pays $50 for these sessions, in line with the cost of seeing other specialists here. He says it's worth it.
I wish I had a video camera so you could have seen him run down the back stairs.
Really?
He went leaping off the last stair because he wanted to play with the kids, and it was like he was a puppy again.
It's a story Moses is pleased to hear.
The progression of my career has been more and more focused on alleviating suffering, and I feel like I now do that in the purest form.
Back in surgery, Moses is on her way to another patient when she spots a tabby cat on a nearby table. The animal is about to have an operation for acute urinary blockage. The procedure entails making a wider opening on a part of the body that is quite sensitive. Moses calls out a question to the cat's surgeon.
Are you doing an epidural on that cat? Okay.
Turns out the vet is.
So the doctor who is in charge of this case is somebody who I helped train as a resident, and he's very astute about pain management.
Moses wants more vets to be that way. With that in mind, she plans to start a consulting service for vets outside her hospital to help them care for animals in pain.
Diane Toomey at Boston's Angel Animal Medical Center. For more, go to here-now.org. Back in 1 minute, here and now. Life of Pi, the phantasmagoric novel about an Indian teenager lost at sea, sharing a life raft with a predatory Bengal tiger, became an international bestseller when it was first released in 2001. The author weaves musings on theology, zoology, and the battle between life and death into the adventure tale with language that is luminous.
The reason death sticks so closely to life isn't biological necessity. It's envy. Life is so beautiful that death has fallen in love with it, a jealous, possessive love that grabs at what it can. But life leaps over oblivion lightly, losing only a thing or two of no importance, and gloom is but the passing shadow of a cloud.
Well, now that rich prose is accompanied by equally lush illustrations in a new edition of the book. Jan Martel is the Canadian writer who won the Man Booker Prize for Life of Pi. He joins us from a CBC studio in Saskatchewan. Welcome.
Hello.
We're also joined by Tomislav Torianets. He won the international contest to illustrate Life of Pi. He joins us as well. Tomislav, welcome to you.
Hi.
And I want to get to that contest, but Jan, for those who haven't yet read it, and I can't recommend it enough, give us a little bit of the arc of the story.
Indian boy's family decides to move to Canada, closes zoo, gets on ship. Ship sinks. Boy ends up on lifeboat with tiger, survives 227 days, gets to Mexico, tells the tale, is not believed by skeptical Japanese investigators, offers possibility of other story. Reader must decide which is true.
There you go. What did lead you to, you know, illustrate the book? We should say there's a glorious author's note that introduces the book that led some people, silly people, including me, to think for a little while that it was a true story, that it was based in fact. When you add what are gorgeous illustrations, but still when you add illustrations, do you sort of take away that, you know, possibility?
Well, first of all, it's news to me that the story wasn't true.
Ye person of little faith.
All good art is true.
Well, and you're absolutely right, because it is entirely possible that a young boy and a Bengal tiger could survive at sea on a raft. I was right with you on that, Jan. And now the contest for the illustrations. And Tomislav, when you first heard about this, had you read the book? Did you have a sense of imagery in your head already? Or how did you approach this?
I had read the book several months prior to entering the competition, and I really loved the book.
What did you love about it?
The introspective quality of it, the fact that it allows for multiple interpretation of its plot and the message it conveys. I couldn't get it out of my head for months.
And many of us have images in our head of who is Pi, the Bengal tiger, the raft at sea. Jan, did you have any opinion as to how those characters should look in illustration?
No, not at all. In fact, I never describe Pi in the novel because it was irrelevant to me what he looked like. What was important was what was happening to him, what he was looking on to.
In fact, Tomislav, almost all of your illustrations are seen from Pi's point of view.
Actually, all of them are seen from Pi's point of view, or they are from his head. The book is written in first person, so seemed natural thing to do.
That's what I loved about Tomislav's conceit, was this idea that the reader becomes Pi, so all you see is his hands and his feet, just as if there were no mirrors, that's all we see of ourselves.
I'm looking at one of the illustrations now. This is of another, to me, she was a major character. This is the orangutan orange juice. What's happened, as you said, the ship has sunk and there were animals on board the ark, if you will, and Pi is on the raft, and who comes floating towards him? Well, as you write, Jan, she came floating on an island of bananas in a halo of light as lovely as the Virgin Mary, the rising sun behind her. Her flaming hair looked stunning. Tomislav, he gave you a lot to work with there.
Yeah. Well, there were two kinds of illustrations. The one who were very well described in the text. A few that weren't, where all I had was only a single quote, a single sentence.
If you're an animal lover, it's tough. It's tough at sometimes because of the animals struggling to survive on the raft. The book warns against anthropomorphism or giving animals human characteristics. The zookeeper's creed is, you know, to remind his son, Pi, that animals are so dangerous. Jan, what are you saying about animals? And then Tomislav, what did you hear him say about animals in the book?
Well, about animals and in their struggles, I would say, yes, there is violence in the novel among animals. But I'd say it's a necessary violence. It's the violence that happens in the natural world, and we delude ourselves about life if we don't acknowledge that level of violence. So it is the violence of predator upon prey, which is in the order of things, and we mustn't ignore that. We mustn't glorify it, but nor must we completely ignore it, because then what we end up ignoring is not so much violence, which is, you know, a good thing to ignore, but we end up ignoring death. And you cannot, I think, plumb the depths of life without having a feel for death, for life's limitations. People often make much about the animal violence, but they forget that later on in the novel, a woman gets murdered and is beheaded. And that hardly anyone mentions that, and I think it's because we're quite inured to human violence, whereas the suffering of animals we perceive as being the suffering of innocence, which is, of course, not at all true. When the zebra, for example, dies, at no point does it say to itself, would it say to itself, this is unfair, because notions of justice don't enter into the animal world.
Although, on the other hand, you go out of your way to say that the most dangerous animal in the zoo, when the zoo was open and people were visiting, was man.
You know, murder is a typically human crime, a typically human act, in part because we're so powerful, of course. So, you know, the typical thing, of course, let's say in an environment where there's, let's say, lynxes and hares. If the lynxes kill too many hares and they starve to death, they pay the price. Unfortunately, with our power and our technology, we are killing vastly more, greater number of species than we should. But our technology is, for the moment, protecting us. But ultimately, that balance of nature will reestablish itself.
Tomislav, I asked you too what you thought that Jan was saying about animals, but maybe even beyond that, about a deeper meaning in the story. It's so layered. The number of days Pi is lost at sea are 227. When 22 is divided by 7, it's a calculation for the mathematical term Pi. Aha! But then we don't really know what that means. do you feel? Are you giving clues too in the pictures?
Well, there are clues in the images. If you look at the one where the quote says the ship was worked out of the dock, and if you look at the clouds, and the clouds are actually a map of Pi's route from India to Canada.
Oh, I see it on page 88. There's the map.
There's a map, and if you take a look at the seagulls, they represent Pi's route.
Look at that. Well. And Jan Martel, we understand you've already begun on the next project, daunting task to follow up such a beloved book as Life of Pi, but you're taking on the Holocaust.
Yes, I've nearly finished the project. It's two things, actually. It's a novel and an essay, and they'll be published together back-to-back, so what the trade calls a flip book, so in other words, a book with two front covers. And I've nearly finished that, and yes, it is a very different topic. Mind you, I'm once again using animals, not in the essay, but in the novel. In the novel, it'll feature a monkey and a donkey. But very, very different in tone from Life of Pi. The animals this time will be completely anthropomorphized, so I'm using them as allegorical figures. In what I'm trying to do there is explore different metaphors, levels of metaphors to do with the Holocaust. One of the points I make in the essay is we haven't allowed ourselves to approach the Holocaust with the metaphorical lightness of touch that we allow ourselves, for example, with war. And so I explore the reasons for that in the essay, and in the novel I try to counter that.
Well, I'm looking forward to it. Jan Martel, he won the Man Booker Prize for Life of Pi. Tomislav Tordianets, he won the international contest to illustrate Life of Pi. And I have to tell you both, I just go through books with a highlighter, except for this one. It's the only one I didn't touch with a highlighter. It's just beautiful. Thank you both for talking to us about it.
Thank you, Robin.
You can listen to Here and Now live each weekday at noon Eastern Time by going to WBUR.org and clicking on the Listen Live button. You can also find us each weekday at noon Eastern on XM Radio Channel 133.